to a place that is not home today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Claudio Rojas was sent back to Argentina recently after 19 years living in the U.S. His family stayed here when he was deported.
Right now, to be honest, I feel like a tourist in Argentina because my heart is still in the U.S. with my family. It's like I haven't quite landed in Argentina yet.
We'll get an update on Claudio's story, just one of thousands of people caught up in President Trump's immigration crackdown. And as Trump signals he wants Homeland Security to get even tougher on immigrants, what's that mean for a department created to focus on counterterrorism?
We've got a lot of issues that are not being addressed by the department because of its focus on unlawful immigration.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. Good to have you here today. President Trump has made it clear he wants a tougher approach to immigration, and he's making big changes at the Department of Homeland Security to get there. We'll hear more on that in a moment. Let's remember that at the heart of each and every immigration policy story is a person, someone like Claudio Rojas. We introduced you to him last month on the show. Claudio is an immigration activist and the protagonist of the new documentary, The Infiltrators.
We came out of the shadows and stopped a few deportations, our own. The new plan? Get into the Broward Detention Center and get people out.
The film is about immigrant activists who get themselves thrown into Florida's Broward Detention Center on purpose in order to organize other detainees. It shows how Rojas and others were able to win their own release. But just days before the film's March premiere in Miami, Rojas was taken into custody again. And although he has no criminal record and has spent 19 years living in the U.S., last week he was deported to Argentina. We reached him today in Buenos Aires.
Bueno, en Argentina en este momento me siento como si fuera un turista en Argentina. No me siento como realmente.
Right now, to be honest, I feel like a tourist in Argentina because I don't feel like a citizen here because my heart is still in the U.S. with my family. And I was used to living there, and that's where my life is. So it's like I haven't quite landed in Argentina yet.
Why do you think you were deported, Claudio? What do you think about what's happened to you?
Well, I lived in the U.S. for 8 years with work permits and the permission to live there legally. And it was only after the movie The Infiltrators was released that I ran into trouble.
So do you think you were deported because you shared your story through that movie? I mean, do you think that maybe the deportation is a form of reprisal?
I have no doubt. I am left with only that scenario because there's never been any other explanation given to me. It is because I told my story in The Infiltrators that this is happening.
And you're pursuing now a lawsuit to try and return to the United States, is that right?
Right now, through my lawyers, I am putting in a request for a visa so that I may be allowed to return to the U.S. I've never been given an explanation why that shouldn't be the case. In fact, when I was arrested, my lawyers had already presented a visa request, so the government, the U.S. government, already has it.
And Claudio, given your suspicions that you were deported because you shared your story in the movie, how hopeful are you that you'll be successful in your lawsuit?
Bueno, yo sigo con la esperanza de que esta visa siga.
I am hopeful that this visa request will go through, but given the way that I was deported, I have many reasons not to be hopeful as well.
Are you in touch with your family here in the U.S. and how are they dealing with this?
Yeah, I'm in contact with my family every day. They are not doing well. It's not a good time for them. Imagine what they're going through, not having the head of the family there with them.
Do you or do they regret your appearance in The Infiltrators?
My family always had mixed feelings. I had mixed feelings about this, but I always had the feeling that I was participating in something that was good to do because I was participating in a project that was denouncing the irregularities by which a lot of people were getting deported under the Obama administration. So I thought that it was a good thing, and I didn't think that it would lead to this.
Of course, things have gotten tougher under President Trump, and we hear potentially bigger changes ahead to U.S. immigration policy from the U.S. government. Are you worried how tougher rules will impact you and your family?
This zero tolerance policy, which is what President Trump says he wants, it doesn't just have the potential to impact my family, it has the potential to impact many families and even legal residents of the United States.
Thank you very much. Muchas gracias.
No, gracias a ustedes por este tiempo. Dios los bendiga.
Thank you for your time, and God bless you.
We reached out to ICE for comment on Claudio Rojas's deportation. A spokesperson wrote us to say ICE cannot comment on the case. The word purge has chilling political connotations, so I was struck to see both the New York Times and the Washington Post use that word, purge, to describe what's going on right now in the Department of Homeland Security. Top officials, including Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen, are losing their jobs. The received wisdom in Washington is that they were not being tough enough. So what's going on? Juliet Kayyem was an assistant secretary at the Department of Homeland Security under President Obama. How do you see the shakeup at DHS, Juliet?
Well, it is a shakeup, and it is real. You can call it a purge. You can call it an ideological cleansing. But what we do know is on the other end of this, Secretary Nielsen, who was the name and face of the cruelest immigration policy in recent U.S. history, the family separation policy, was not harsh enough for the president of the United States. And the replacement team, whether it's at the Secret Service, FEMA, Customs and Border Protection, or in the secretary's office, will be those who are more focus on ideological purity rather than operational success. And what I mean by that is these are going to be people who talk the talk of Trump's tough immigration line and who do not care about any of the normal metrics that would determine whether a policy is useful, helpful, or even moral.
It's been widely reported that several agencies within the DHS felt the need to send out a memo last week. You probably saw this reported to remind staff that they need to follow the law and could be personally liable if they broke it by doing what Trump apparently said to some of them last week, to basically not let migrants in. And if judges give them trouble about it, to say, sorry, judge, we don't have the room. Do you seriously think it would happen that Trump could push DHS staff to cross that line?
No. Look, it is never good when the president of the United States says, defy courts and do what I need you to do based on, you know, and I'm honest with you about this. I mean, just based on sheer cruelty, it is not like the family separation policy was successful. Unlawful family crossings have gone up since we started separating families. So this is a bad thing to have the president doing it. It is consistent with the president's autocratic tendencies. It challenges our constitutional norms. But why do I think that he will not be listened to? And why do I think that that leads to his frustration? And the reason why is because the Department of Homeland Security, as I was often reminded when I was in the department as a political appointee, there are 250,000 of them and only 100 of us. The math is that these agents and agencies need to do what is lawful because they will protect themselves.
What would happen to agents and staff at DHS who do cross that line?
They would be personally liable. I mean, in other words, if a CBP agent violated the law and knowingly violated the law, so it would be worse than negligently violated. I mean, if you knowingly violated law, you're not going to get any protections because the president said to you in passing, break the law. I mean, what's your defense? So the president said in passing to break the law, a prosecutor is going to say, and you believed him, right? This isn't to say there aren't agents that seem to love the president or seem to love the whole, close the borders thing. But I actually think the closing the borders drama that we went through over the last week, where the president says, I'm going to close the borders, everyone has to jump because the president said it. But then you saw an entire apparatus roll its eyes, get the Senate Republicans to tell Trump to back off, and he backs off. Again, a sign of weakness, not a sign of strength. So I think that the agents know that this administration too will end, and they will not make themselves personally liable for the whims of a president who will not, as they've seen, who will not defend you if in fact you are arrested.
What it looks like right now, Juliet, is that Trump seems to be pushing DHS to focus entirely on the border. What's not getting attention that could be real security problems for the U.S.?
Yeah, that's such a great question. I think so important. So the president has done what the department had been trying to get away from for almost a decade. So the department is formed as a counterterrorism department in 2002. In 2005, the department itself had a major course correction after the tragedy of Hurricane Katrina, when we realized, those of us in the field realized, that a federal apparatus too focused on stopping, you know, 19 terrorists from getting on four airplanes again, a noble effort, could not save an American city from drowning. And so we pivoted, and we, people like me, who happened, you know, who were counterterrorism experts, began to describe ourselves as homeland security experts. We began to understand that and take what's called an all hazards approach. Trump has reversed that course correction, and he looks at homeland security solely through the end of unlawful migration, which is such a limited end. So meanwhile, you've got climate change, which the administration denies. You've got a measles outbreak, as if it's 1860, and you've got, you know, leadership in the White House, including the president, somewhat skeptical of vaccination. You have cyber attacks and cyber vulnerabilities, which have not been addressed in time for 2020, and you still have terrorism, but a different kind of terrorism, and including and especially right-wing terrorism that we're seeing rear its head, which is not being condemned by the president himself. So we've got a lot of issues that are not being addressed by the department because of its focus on unlawful immigration, but are actually in some ways being made worse because of the president's sort of lack of fact-based policy making when it comes to the climate, to vaccinations, to right-wing terrorism, and to the Russians' attempts to undermine us in our elections.
That is a pretty healthy list, sad to say. Juliet Kayyem, Assistant Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security under President Obama, thank you as always.
Thank you so much, Marco.
Disarray and big changes at the Department of Homeland Security. People, heads of families, deported. In the Trump era, one symbol captures all of that, a wall. The powerful symbolism of a structure that's meant to divide, to keep people apart. People get it, have gotten it since Trump first hit the campaign trail and talked about building a wall. Little surprise that the wall would eventually lead to a song by three Latin rock bands that, let's just say, keep it pretty real. This is from the new album by Grupo Fantasma, featuring their friends from L.A., Ozo Motley, and from Miami, Locos Por Juana, a song called The Wall. Everybody listen up, cause this is happening now. The moment is so critical, I said it too loud. If you can hear me in your ear, well then I'm punching the crowd. Got 96 possibilities to ollie your bow. Life and liberty, justice for publicity. When it gets to everybody, man, please come and get at me. Oh, history, don't even live to see that can of worms digging holes in your legacy. Walls are bound to fall, expel treachery. My pot is melting, best switch your recipe. Mente positiva, venimos a cambiar. Mente positiva, venimos a luchar. Mente positiva, venimos a cambiar. New music from Grupo Fantasma and Company, The Wall, a track from their new album, American Music, Volume 7. Not only is the title ironic, Grupo Fantasma recorded it at a studio called Sonic Ranch in the border town of Tornillo, Texas. Not long after the recording session wrapped, Tornillo leapt into the news because it's the site of the infamous detention center where kids were kept after getting separated from their parents. Nobody here is illegal. Go the lyrics from Grupo Fantasma and Friends. You're tuned to The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. Yesterday, we told you on the show about online regulations they're considering in the UK, regulations that would crack down on hate speech, terrorist propaganda, disinformation, other harmful content. It's all packed into a white paper released by the UK government. Jeremy Wright is the Secretary of State for Digital, Culture, Media, and Sport, and one of the government officials who put together the proposal to regulate online content. He told us the UK is just the latest place to try and tighten controls on social media.
Many other countries are experiencing exactly the same kinds of challenges. And everyone is looking for a way in which we can balance the need to keep a vibrant, thriving, open internet on the one hand, with, on the other hand, keeping our citizens safe from serious online harms. That's something we're all struggling with. And so finding a way through that is something we're all interested to do.
Other countries, Australia most recently, Germany before Australia, have passed legislation on harmful online content. I know some people have argued that the country-by-country approach when it comes to regulating these tech companies is fracturing the internet. It'll lead to a whole bunch of different rule sets that don't necessarily conform with each other. Do you agree with that?
Well, I understand the concern, and it's perfectly true that the best way of doing this would be for the whole world to do it at once in exactly the same way. But I think that will take a very long time to happen. And we have to make a choice. Do we either wait for everyone to agree before we act at all, or do we set out what we believe is the appropriate way to deal with these harms and hope very much, as I do, that other countries will look at the way in which we propose to do this and may be able to find something in that approach that they think will work for them too.
It sounds, Mr. Secretary, like you see the importance of unity in regulating social media across the globe. Is that the long-term goal? And if that is, why not start now?
Well, we are starting now in the sense that what we are doing is setting out a path that, as I say, I think others may wish to follow too. But my primary responsibility is to keep safe the citizens of the United Kingdom. That's what I'm obligated to do. And it seems to me necessary to act with urgency to make sure that we can do that. One other thing I'll say, we're very keen to make sure that we've taken on board views from those who are active in this space, who are concerned about these issues and have something to add to the conversation, which is why we're consulting now. And we want to make sure that we hear what people have to say before we take the next step.
Right. It's a three-month public comment period. What happens after this three-month period? Because there's a chaotic state of the British government, Prime Minister May's potential resignation. Do you think these proposals stand a chance of becoming law?
Well, I wouldn't say, of course, that there's a chaotic state in the UK government. We are, of course, dealing with some unprecedentedly difficult issues in leaving the European Union. But government has to do more than just deal with leaving the European Union. And I think what I picked up yesterday from the announcement of these proposals was a good deal of support across the political spectrum. So what we're going to do is we're going to go on and develop these proposals, move towards legislation which we'll need to put many of these elements into practice. And I look forward to having broadly based support for that.
Jeremy Wright, one of the UK government officials pushing for regulating harmful social media content. They put out a white paper yesterday outlining their proposals. Secretary Wright, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
A woman who sells wedding dresses, but she does not respect the institution of marriage, thinks it's backwards. It's a contradiction, but that's what this remarkable next story is about. In Turkey, the coastal city of Izmir is the heart of the country's bridal gown industry. Reporter Duri Baskaran introduces us to a dress seller who turned bridal gowns into a conversation starter about violence against women.
On the first floor of Gökçe Wedding Dress, 30-year-old Dilan Engin is selling a dream.
Hala popüler gençler arasında çok popüler bir model bu.
This is the princess model, a sequin-fitted bodice paired with a wide, puffy skirt. Then there's the Helen style, more of a classic line, and the sleek, shimmery balık.
Balık, like a fish.
On weekends, this neighborhood is full of brides and their families, popping in store after store to find the perfect gown. But Engin doesn't actually like wedding dresses. They remind her of old gender roles, she says. The idea that getting married, having kids, is a woman's only purpose in life.
I don't like marriage.
Despite her own views, Engin is a good saleswoman. On the floors above the showroom, Engin helps out with the detailing, measuring, and fitting dresses. Engin started doing this work to pay the bills after she finished film school in 2016, and it inspired her to make a short documentary using the promise of a wedding dress as a metaphor. Engin says it starts with this song, Senefetsen Benefetme. 5 years ago, she says, she heard a news headline on the radio as she sat sewing tiny beads on a dress.
Radyodan bir kadın cinayeti haberi duyuldu.
It was about a woman who was killed by her husband. Then Engin heard this song by Bergen, a popular Turkish arabesque singer, whose husband threw acid on her face and blinded her in one eye. He later shot and killed her.
Şarkıyı dinledikten sonra ben ne yapıyorum diye sordum. Yani bir kadının umudu olan gelinliği dikiyorum.
After listening to the song, I asked myself, what am I doing here? I'm sowing the hopes of this woman, her husband. And how should I say it? I noticed the paradox. I'm sewing a woman's wedding dress, but it could become her burial shroud.
In the film, the women who work in the shop put together a wedding dress as they talk about their own relationships, divorces, and the pressure to marry.
Cinderella da hayatının aşkını arıyor, gelinler de.
I think about the story of Cinderella. She looks for the love of her life, just like the brides, but the truth becomes visible after midnight, just like in Cinderella.
Human rights groups say more than 400 women are killed every year in Turkey, in a phenomenon that mirrors just about every other country in the world. Most of the victims are killed by their intimate partners or close family members. In Turkey, there's a term for these killings, says Engin's co-producer, Sertaç Koyuncu.
Kadın cinayetleri.
Women murders.
Because it's a very usual thing in Turkey, so it's a category. We just say women murder.
Engin and Koyuncu made their film, Princess Ballgown, with a small grant they won from a cinematographers association. It's now winding its way through the Turkish film festival circuit, where they hope to start a conversation about violence against women in Turkey. For now, Engin is still selling wedding dresses, despite her own feelings about them.
Yine o kül kedisi masalındaki gibi umudun, beklentinin,
to society, the wedding dress is about hope. It's the expectation of a happy ending.
Once she finds a way, Engin says, she'll be back behind the camera. She already has 3 more scripts ready to go. For The World, Duri Buscarin, İzmir, Turkey.
I'm Marco Werman. Polish General Kazimierz Pulaski helped America win its independence from Britain. History books will tell you that. Now his bones tell a new story about the Revolutionary War hero.
The skeleton looks very female.
Scientists say Pulaski was intersex, born with male and female anatomy. That story still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. There is no question, Cubans love their baseball.
Póngale música, maestro! Esto es locura, amigo! Locura!
Not just announcers and fans, it's part of the national identity. For years, there was a steady stream of Cuban players to the U.S. major leagues, until Fidel Castro shut it down decades ago. These days, some Cuban players take enormous risks to sneak into the U.S. That would have changed thanks to a deal that Major League Baseball made with the Cuban Baseball Federation in December, a deal that would have allowed Cuban players to sign with U.S. teams. In exchange, the teams would have paid the Cuban Baseball Federation a fee, tens of millions of dollars in some cases. But now, the Trump administration has put a stop to the Cuban baseball deal. Julio Ricardo Varela is a co-host of the podcast In the Thick. Why did the Trump administration stop this deal? What rationale did it give?
I think it was the rationale that you're not supposed to be doing business with, there's an embargo and don't do business with the Cuban government.
Wasn't there this other deal that was negotiated back in December? I mean, and why was that deal negotiated in the first place?
That deal started with Obama, when relations between Cuba and the United States were starting to get loosened. I mean, the last time you and I talked about this, Marco, we kind of said that the Trump administration might not even approve it.
Yeah.
So essentially, before this deal, the only way Cuban ball players could play in Major League Baseball is that they literally had to escape the island. Some of them defected. So, for example, Yasiel Puig, who now plays for the Cincinnati Reds, but before he was playing for the Los Angeles Dodgers, his story of how he was smuggled out, the money that was put in to pay smugglers, how he got to L.A. I mean, in a way, it kind of reads like a human it is. It's a human trafficking story. So I do think that there was a part of Major League Baseball that says, you know, we don't want to be the league that, you know, is like, yay, human trafficking. So when the Obama administration began to open relations with Cuba, MLB took advantage of it. They negotiated directly with the Cuban Baseball Federation, and they said, all right, if we're going to take on these players, we will give you a fee, just like a transfer fee. But this is very common. I mean, if you look at Japan, you know, these transfer fees for some of the top Japanese stars were always given to the Japanese teams. So it was kind of like, instead of giving money to a team, you're giving it to a federation. But critics would argue that that baseball federation in Cuba is actually just an arm of the Cuban regime.
So there could have been millions of dollars for Cuba. Is that all they wanted out of this deal?
Yeah. And if you see like what National Security Advisor John Bolton and Senator Marco Rubio, they basically said straight up, you're just giving money to a repressive regime. Bolton took it another step further, saying, if we give money to Cuba, you're also going to give money to Venezuela because Cuba is running Venezuela. So it got into this sort of geopolitical, you know, where we're at now in Latin America between the right and the left. You know,
what reaction have you heard, Julio, from players and teams on either side of the Florida Straits?
So in the case of Yankee reliever Aroldis Chapman, who's Cuban, who left, right? He's the closer for the Yankees, the relief pitcher. He was asked on Monday about this decision by the Trump administration and basically said he felt bad for the young ball players because he said they're not going to have the opportunity to play in the United States. And Chapman basically makes reference to the fact that the way we, you know, his crop, his generation of Cuban ball players, the way they got to the United States, he said it was tough to say the least. And he just basically said, you know, this might not be a definite, just got to wait and see what happens.
Does this mean you think that Cuban players are going to have to resort again to getting smuggled into the U.S.?
Well, I mean, how else, if they really want to get here, I mean, what are their options? I mean, it's too early to tell, but are we just back to where we started?
Do you think baseball is Trump's way of reversing Obama's Cuba policy in slow motion?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the problem is it's baseball.
Why is that a problem?
I mean, it's like you're going after the American pastime. This is what America's all about.
Julio Ricardo Varela, the co-host of the podcast In the Thick. Thanks.
Thanks, Marco.
The White House hosted the president of Egypt today. Abdel Fattah al-Sisi is a retired army general who came to power in 2013. The Egyptian parliament has now opened the door to constitutional reforms that would allow Sisi to be president until 2034. The United States has a long history with Egypt, but what does Donald Trump's embrace of Sisi say about that relationship? Nancy O'Kale is executive director of the Tahrir Institute for Middle East Policy in Washington. And Nancy, you know the extent of authoritarianism in Egypt. You were one of a few dozen people working for foreign-funded NGOs in Egypt and was convicted and sentenced to prison in 2012. What were you charged with?
I was charged with operating an office without a license and receiving funding from a foreign government without a license. And of course, like, those two charges were not based on any evidence. And in December of 2018, the 43 of us who were convicted in the case in June of 2013, we all got acquitted with a justification for the verdict from court saying that receiving foreign funding for civil society work is not a crime.
So you were acquitted, but I mean, in the aftermath, did you feel like you had to leave the country? I mean, was that the next step?
I left the country in the middle of 2012, and that was in the middle of the trial, which took a year and a half. And I was sentenced in absentia for 5 years in prison. And since then, I have been living in exile in the United States.
And what does your exile tell us about your concerns about President Sisi?
Well, the situation is that there is a repression of all sorts of freedom of assembly, freedom of association, freedom of expression. And of course, one of the biggest targets are the civil society organization, particularly those who are working on human rights. The other thing is that since 2013 and the declaration of the war and terror, there are several repressive approaches and policies that have been practiced under the umbrella of the war and terror. Of course, there are many people who are apolitical, has nothing to do with the Islamists. They might be just satirists or actors or artists who are now in prison under charges of terrorism and threat to national security.
Isn't that what successive U.S. administrations have asked Egypt to do, to be America's broker in the so-called global war on terror?
The U.S. has always framed the relationship between the United States and Egypt as a strategic relationship based on the role that Egypt play in the region, as well as its ability to crack down and contain and eliminate terrorism or Islamic extremism. But this is not an exceptional period. Mm. It has always been the case with U.S. politics toward the Middle East and towards Egypt, that as long as whatever is happening internally is contained and it's not having a spillover effect, which is like the politics of containment, then they would be okay with continuation of the relationship with Egypt, evidently by having the $1.3 billion military aid every year.
As far as Trump and Sisi, I mean, they're together at the White House today, and their relationship does seem somewhat unprecedented. We saw them first bonding over that glowing orb with the King of Saudi Arabia. How would you describe Trump and Sisi's relationship, and do you see that relationship as the de facto U.S. policy toward Egypt right now?
So I don't have high hopes that President Trump would raise the issue of human rights or the constitutional amendments or the freedom of expression with President Sisi, because Trump himself has been befriending a lot of authoritarian leaders around the world. But he's not so different from the previous president of the United States. Again, if you look at the relationship between Egypt and the United States over the past 40 years, you would see that it has always been a relationship that had continued without any disruption. The photo op at the Oval Office is a stamp of approval to all what's been going on inside the country.
Nancy O'Kale, the executive director of the Tahrir Institute for Middle East Policy, speaking with us from Washington. Thank you very much, Nancy.
Thank you.
Iran's President Hassan Rouhani condemned the United States on Iran state television today. You should understand that today more than ever, the IRGC is popular and beloved among Iranians, Rouhani said. He goes on to call the United States the leader of world terrorism. This comes after the Trump administration took the dramatic step of labeling the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, or the IRGC, a terrorist organization. Jarrett Blanc is with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He led the implementation of the Iran nuclear deal under President Obama. What is unprecedented about this, Jarrett, labeling another country's military as a terrorist organization?
It's very narrowly unprecedented. In the past, the foreign terrorist organization designation has been used for non-state actors and not for state actors. But the IRGC, Iran, other aspects of the Iranian government are designated under dozens of other authorities, including terrorism authorities. So the administration is making a big deal about the exceptional nature of this step. It's kind of a piece with our policy toward Iran since the 1980s.
I mean, this announcement has come down. A lot of people are talking about the IRGC. What position does it occupy exactly in the Iranian military?
Well, it's a part of the Iranian military. During the Iran-Iraq War, which is really the formative political event, I think, of the Islamic Republic, it played a critical role in mobilizing relatively untrained, unequipped popular support to hold back Iraq. And it has expanded its role ever since. So it plays a role in domestic regime preservation. It plays a role in defending the borders. It plays a role in aggressively asserting Iranian interests in the region and abroad. And of course, it's also assumed a fairly large role in Iran's economy. I sometimes think that when people say the IRGC, they're really kind of using a shorthand that in the United States we might call the military-industrial complex.
Well, that's a really good point, because it's not just about the military security in Iran. The one thing I found when I was in Iran a couple of years ago was that something you did not discuss with anyone was the business interests of the Revolutionary Guard. So why is that such a toxic issue?
Well, because it's extremely unpopular in Iran, and so the IRGC has wanted, I think, to establish that position of power and hasn't wanted a lot of debate about it. I would also say that to the extent that there's a way to change the IRGC's role in the Iranian economy, it's got to be long-term, and it's certainly not what the Trump administration is doing. I think that we were starting to see, and there's only anecdotal evidence of this, but I think that we were starting to see under the implementation of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the Iran nuclear deal, the IRGC reducing its position in Iran's real economy, selling off industrial assets and, you know, putting that money into real estate or other things. And there's a reason for that, which is that when Iran is under very, very severe sanctions, there's a huge benefit to having a partner or an owner that's able to work in the black market or the gray market, and the IRGC does that. When Iran is under looser sanctions, but the IRGC is still sanctioned, which is what was going on under the nuclear deal, now you've got a real liability if you're owned or partnered with the IRGC, because if a European auto parts company wants to work with you, they can't. And so there's no longer the advantage of working in the black and gray market, and there's a huge disadvantage of being partnered up with a toxic entity.
A move like this, labeling the IRGC a terrorist organization, it's been debated for years. Why now?
That's a great question, and I'm certainly not plugged into the high levels of the Trump administration to be able to answer it. It's been debated, I think, largely because, as almost a sort of semiotic point, it makes sense. The IRGC is a terrorist organization. But on the other hand, there are risks. There are risks that Iran might rise to the bait, which they have not done for previous provocations out of Washington, and lead to an escalatory cycle. There's also a risk that just at some lower level, a commander might see this rhetorical back and forth and say, hey, we've got a terrorist on the other side of the battlefield, whether that's in Iraq, Syria, in the Gulf, or elsewhere, and provoke a flare-up that neither side was really intending.
So, I mean, do you see this as any kind of pressure on Iran at all, a designation like this?
I do not think that it is meaningful pressure on Iran at all. The IRGC, the government of Iran, are so substantially sanctioned already that I don't see there being any new pressure here.
What are you going to be watching for next, Jarrett?
Well, again, I think that it's entirely possible that it just ends here. Both sides have made their point, and we move on with a bad but not deteriorating relationship. I think there's a big question about what this means from Washington. Is this an indication that the hardliners in the Trump administration have won the debate and they're going to keep pressing until they create a crisis? Alternatively, is it an indication that they've lost the debate and this was just sort of a not particularly substantive sop that was thrown to them? Or finally, you know, this is an administration that has real problems with internal policy coordination. Is this just a decision in a vacuum that doesn't tell us anything really about what comes next with Iran?
Jarrett Blanc, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He was the State Department's lead coordinator for implementing the Iran nuclear deal under President Obama. Jarrett, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Two things you should know about Revolutionary War hero Kazimir Pulaski. He's the father of the American cavalry, and he was intersex, born with both male and female chromosomes and anatomy. That aspect of his identity wasn't known during his lifetime in the 1700s. But several years ago, Kazimir Pulaski's skeletal remains were exhumed in Savannah, Georgia, when the monument they were in was in disrepair. That gave scientists a chance to do a full forensic workup. And that's where Virginia Hutton Estabrook comes into the picture. She's an anthropology professor at Georgia Southern University who worked on the Pulaski case. And she says when they exhumed the skeleton, they discovered something surprising.
What was discovered then was that the skeleton looks very female. For all of the points that we use forensically to look at sex, all of those points skewed in the very female direction. There's some geometry of a female pelvis that basically widens the birth canal area a bit, and sort of like ways these things are expressed and are all very female looking.
And what do these female traits tell us then about General Kazimir Pulaski?
What they tell us is that there is some level of female pattern development happening in Pulaski in this person that we have baptismal records from, and he's baptized as Casimir, and he's baptized as the son of his parents. And this linguistic difference in social sciences between sex and gender actually comes to pretty good use here. His gender was absolutely masculine throughout his life. There's no question of what his kind of social role was from birth on. And because he was baptized as a son, there's early portraits of him that clearly show facial hair and, you know, even some little like hair, male pattern baldness thinning going on, that there's definitely features that show some presence of androgens happening in his body. So this is where we get the intersex idea.
So what would all of this have meant back in the 1700s? I mean, as an anthropologist, do you have any sense of how someone who was intersex, perhaps in the 1700s, would have been viewed by, I don't know, their family, their colleagues, and maybe more importantly for Casimir Pulaski, his troops under his command?
We've tried to look a lot in written records about him in letters to see if there's sort of anything about that that we can really see manifest in any of his relationships. One thing we do know about Pulaski was that he was never married. There's discussions of him being a little removed from people, sort of possibly a little bit aloof, but again, sort of grain of salt with this, that he really didn't speak English.
Right.
Very much coming here. So that's, but he was obviously very amiable, chatty, especially to people he could speak French with and things. So,
Professor, what do you find compelling about this discovery?
So from an anthropological perspective, what's really important about this is that we really don't know how intersex conditions affect skeletal development. That means that we just don't know what intersex looks like, if there are any kind of diagnostic telltale signs that we should be maybe looking for. Something that I did not really realize going into this was how common intersex actually is. Just in the population, it's one in 1,500 births and possibly as common as like one in 100 if you cast a slightly wider net around what is an intersex condition versus not. So this is actually a relatively common thing that we've not included these stories really in our interpretations of the past, which makes having the skeletal remains of an individual that we know a lot about his life so unique. And then there's the whole Pulaski side of this that makes this story interesting too. That,
why is that interesting? Because I read this news and I was fascinated by it over the weekend, but I kind of came to the end of the story and I was like, well, so what if Pulaski had a pelvic bone that was more female than male? What does that actually do to our understanding of a Revolutionary War hero or of the time he lived in?
This doesn't really change what Pulaski did or, you know, his legacy. What this does change is that intersex people who've been largely erased from any kind of history, this is the presence of at least one that we know about. So this is an individual that has been celebrated, has lots of streets and highways and cities and counties named after him that could possibly be this intersex hero and be relevant for a new group of people that he really hasn't been, you know, sort of terribly necessarily relevant to in the past.
Dr. Estabrook, is it determined now for sure that Casimir Pulaski was intersex, for sure?
What we have that's fairly certain is that this is Pulaski in this this monument. What's also fairly certain is that this skeleton has these very, very female features, and yet we have this life of Pulaski that we need to reconcile with those very female features. You know, the best hypothesis currently is that it's intersex. Coming to some kind of idea of what kind of intersex or figuring out what the sex chromosomes are is not currently possible at this time. So we were unable to extract any nuclear DNA from these remains that would, you know, sort of really show, you know, which intersex condition and what's going on chromosomally.
The monument to Pulaski is still there in Savannah, yeah?
Oh, yes. Yes, yes, yes. And Pulaski is no longer buried inside of the monument. He's buried alongside the monument. There's a marble slab that almost all of his skeletal remains are buried underneath.
Do you think the plaque, I'm assuming there's a plaque at the monument, should the plaque be rewritten at some point?
It's a hard thing to say what should be on the plaque, because at some level there should be an acknowledgement of intersex, but also his accomplishments were not that he was intersex. His accomplishments that he was, you know, Casimir Pulaski, the guy who created a really, really functional American cavalry at a time when this was like cutting edge technology and was this charismatic leader that inspired lots and lots of people around him.
Maybe it's just a PS at the bottom of the plaque. Oh, by the way, he was intersex.
Yeah, it's right. It's kind of a difficult thing because you don't want the Pulaski story just to be about that he's intersex.
Right.
Because that's really not most of his story. That's just kind of like this extra little tidbit. But, you know, this is also this tidbit that might completely cast a different light on aspects of his story that we haven't really thought about or haven't really looked at in such great detail in examining his biography as maybe, you know, we could or should have in the future.
Virginia Hutton Estabrook is an anthropology professor at Georgia Southern University. She's been speaking with us about Polish-born American Revolutionary War hero Casimir Pulaski. Thank you so much. Great to meet you.
Oh, gosh, my pleasure. Well, thank you.
Fascinating discovery there. And that's The World for this Tuesday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.